Andy, what's going on, bro? Welcome back, man. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, I was very excited to come back. Love the first chat. I'm looking forward to this one. And yeah, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Just nice weather for November. And keeping up with I you know I you all your content is like it's very like real, let's say, yet scientific. And I could probably learn a thing or two from how you do things. So big props for that.
Likewise, dude. Likewise. And thank you for that. You know, when you DM me and you're like, bro, get me back on the podcast and we'll talk about some liver stuff. I couldn't have been more excited, you know? So I'm happy we got to honestly link up and do this as quick as we were able to, but it's going to be a good extension off of our last conversation, which if the listener hasn't listened to that, I'd really recommend you going back because I think that could just lay a lot of framework and just lay the foundation for what we're going to build and expand upon today because we touched on the liver for honestly like 30 minutes or so. I actually went back and listened to our podcast episode last night just to kind of, I just don't want us to repeat the same things. Even if we do that, that's fine. But just building off stuff that we've already talked about, but I'm going to link those though, or that episode in the show notes. So go listen to that before you listen to the rest of this podcast, if you haven't already. But, dude, before we get into that, any updates on your end? You don't need to do the podcast intro or anything, but any things you've been passionate about lately, things you've been, making content around, like what's kind of been the forefront of your mind on the nutrition front or even just like personal stuff in life?
I'll give you one personal one, one professional one. I mean, on the personal side, I was lucky enough to go watch a Real Madrid game, Champions League game. So that's like a soccer team for those who may not know, and that's like a big passion of mine outside nutrition. So that was epic. Professional side, I think since we last spoke, I think I probably dropped my online course in community for fatty liver. So yeah, one of each. There you go.
Part of the reason why I wanted to get you on today, but man, the Real Madrid game, did you go see, was that a home game for them or did you go to a different
Home
stadium?
game. Yeah, it was home game. Bernabeu is very very special. Like nutrition and soccer for me are like right beside each other, right? Like in terms of like how much I care and how much I talk about them. So I nerd out on soccer as much as I nerd on nutrition.
I think that's a really healthy thing. Like I think in general, like people having different forms of like escapism and not that like soccer is a huge escapism. I think it is, but like in the States, like people have football teams or fans that they like to root for or different sports that they might like to play. Or here in Nevada, like we love hiking, it's ski season, like golfing, like there's just so many outdoor things that people can do. Man, some people do puzzles, some people knit. Like the more I've been in this coaching space, the more I've been an advocate for people finding shit that they like to do outside of the gym, outside of eating well, outside of going on a walk. And I think that like something as simple as soccer that you can travel to and eat good food and kind of just like take a break from what you do as a profession. Of course, this speaks to other people who are lawyers or doctors or accountants or, people in an office. It's like have other things out there, like besides fitness and besides your job that brings you enjoyment and lean into that. I've kind of been somebody who's like shit on that a little bit in my own life. And I'm just like, no, I've realized the importance of that. And I've almost like enjoyed consuming that content or like putting myself in positions where I'm not just thinking about nutrition all the time. So I feel like that's a good example of like what soccer is for you is, what golf or playing basketball or all these intramural sports that we're playing and doing co-ed stuff. Like I've just found a lot of enjoyment doing things outside the gym recently. So I share that with you.
You know what? Let's just explore that for a second. It's actually interesting because now there's probably like diminishing returns on spending too much time in one area in some ways, right? Like even to care about soccer. I care about soccer a lot, but like I'm not, and I don't begrudge any big fans, but I don't care about the level where if a certain team wins or loses, like it's gonna affect my week, right? And then nutrition equally. I spent a lot of time learning about science, but science only evolves so quickly. There's not gonna be a revelation every week. You know what I mean? So you're gonna get minimal gains on caring about something too much, burdening yourself, and so on, right? Now, like there's limitations to that statement that I just made, and you can have a whole debate about that, but I think there's like some truth to that. And I just thought I would share that just to bounce off what you said.
Yeah, bro, I agree. I agree. And I like that you use that diminishing returns example because it's like that with a lot of things. Like I'll use football as an example here because a lot of people of my age, my demographic, people in America, they love football. They love NFL Sundays. They love rooting for their favorite teams. And it's like, I like rooting for these teams too, And for me, there was a point in my life where I took time away. I didn't really watch a lot of sports. I kind of confounded by the fact that I was starting my business and I was working full time and I was doing a lot of other things that took me away from just like extra leisure time to just watch and turn on a football game for, you know, 4 hours or whatever it is. But I've gotten back to the point where it's swung to the other side of the pendulum or somewhere in the middle where it's like, yeah, you know what? There's a healthy balance where maybe watching 9 hours of football every Sunday for 14 weeks straight, like might not be the best thing for me, but yeah, tuning in every now and then or watching a fun game or, you know, playing fantasy football or, you know, playing sports or doing whatever it else. It's like, that's the stuff that still can bring enjoyment, value. But it can be taken too far, just like anything, and leads to more stress, leads to just more frustration, just leads to a place where it's taking you away from other things that are actually going to give you like a better return on your investment from like a time allocation standpoint, that there's definitely a balancing act between the two. So I find that funny because I've experienced that on my own, but it's just been fascinating to see that play out in my life and see it play out in other people's as well.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I'm going to watch a little bit of the Ravens Bengals game today. Cause like, I'm not a big NFL fan, but like, I do like what like Lamar Jackson is about and how he plays. And so they're definitely an interesting storyline for me. Yeah. So just to say, I know a little something about the NFL, not my main thing though.
Totally, man. Totally. Well, good. And for those of you who aren't familiar, Andy's from Canada. So sports interests, things change a little bit, but yeah, there's a lot of overlap just cause we're in the same, you know, continent at the end of the day. But cool, man. I love that. Thanks for all those updates. I mentioned that I'd listened back to our last episode and quite frankly, like I thought we did a decent job just covering a lot of basics around things. And I'm thinking about like what the liver does and what its functions are. We talked around kind of this whole like detoxification kind of process that happens with the liver and all the other organs within our body and how they're all kind of interconnected. We talked about liver health. We talked about like labs and blood markers to look for, to keep in mind, things to monitor, you know, metabolic health, liver enzymes, things that we can kind of keep an eye on proactively as humans to just see how things are going in our blood work. We also talked about just like some supplements, things that we'll probably dive in a little bit more on today, but then also just, just conceptualizing like what it means to be a healthy person and what it means to have a healthy liver and why that's important. And I think keeping all of that in mind, I think there's room for more nuanced discussions around certain things when it comes to liver health in general. And again, like I don't want to have this be just a regurgitation of everything we talked about on the last podcast, but I do want to just lay the foundation and give a reminder for what, you know, the liver does and what it's there for. And I know you just mentioned you had a course, part of the reason why I wanted to talk about the liver again today, but from an over, you know, 10,000 foot view, just an oversimplification, just give us a reminder of why the liver is important, why it's one of the more important organs. All our organs are important, let's be real, but why the liver is especially important. And, you know, what are some functions of that kind of keep us healthy day to day? Let's just start with that.
Yeah. And I know you'll like reorient me if I get too much, too repetitive, but I mean, look, the thing is, people like to oversimplify things, right? And that's going to come up again today, I guarantee you. People like to, like, the liver does over 500 functions in the human body, okay? We think of it mostly as like a detoxifying organ. Like most of the blood in the human body flows through the liver, right? So, you know, there's detoxification going on, you know, for other drugs and alcohol, the obvious ones, and then expands from there. Like the liver plays a very important role in fat and carbohydrate metabolism, which means like, you know, it plays a role in regulating blood sugar levels, regulating blood fat levels. These are just, you know, absolutely fundamental things. The liver is directly connected to the digestive system through the portal vein. So like the gut microbiome and the liver health are strongly connected, right? The liver creates bile acids, which helps to digest fat in the digestive system when you eat fat. And so it's like, you know, every function, enzymatic reaction, stuff that is even beyond our pay grade, the liver has a hand in that. And I think that's part of the reason why people find it so fascinating. And, you know, all for a little 3 pound, 3 to 4 pound little thing.
Totally, dude. And, you know, when I think of like the leading causes of death and metabolic disease and things that kills humans early, and kind of a morbid way to say that, but, you know, I think of things, and I know you can kind of relate to this as well, stuff that we've been taught in our undergrad, things that we see play out today, but we think about things like heart disease, we think about things like diabetes, we think about things like, you know, different forms of cancer, we think about things like stroke, respiratory disease, COPD, like, you know, mentally, Alzheimer's, dementia, like there's a lot of things that are emerging and people are struggling with and suffering from as we, you know, age and as we get, you know, older and progress through life. I don't know about you, and I already know you already know this, but like liver disease is something that I've seen emerge like as a top contributor and, you know, maybe not a contributor, but something else that is in this classification of what is making people sick and diseases that people are struggling with or diseases that are being diagnosed more now, in addition to all the really common metabolic kind of diseases, things that we're seeing today. And I'm seeing personally, like kind of in my practice and even in my experience as a dietitian and the clinical settings of like, man, people at in their 20s and 30s and 40s, like getting, you know, alcoholic or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, having cirrhosis, like having these fucked up things happen to their liver and having that unfortunately lead to death or other complications that are, you know, some are irreversible and, you know, others are things that we can control at the end of the day. But fatty liver disease is something I'm seeing emerge more and more as we get deeper and as we continue to you know, continue practicing and working with clients. And I'm curious if you've noticed those trends as well and, you know, why that is something that we should be talking about or we should be encouraging people to keep in the back of their minds, just like we screen for prediabetes, just like we check your blood pressure, just like we check your lipid panel. Like why, you know, why the liver is also part of this equation as well. But do you see that? You can tell me if I'm full of shit, but you know, what have you seen in your practice and what would you tell to people just to help them appreciate the importance of the liver in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, look, fatty liver disease, NAFLD, it's now being called MASLD, metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. They mean, they more or less, they mean the same thing. Fat accumulates in your liver cells where it shouldn't be. I mean, the prevalence has gone up. It's happening specifically in men. It's happening younger. I think the 20 to 29 demographic, it's happening younger in men, specifically in adolescents, it's happening more frequently. I had a conversation actually with a prominent local doctor and he gave me a number where he said fatty liver was responsible in the past. It's been responsible for 2% of liver transplants, but in the years ahead, it'll be responsible for 20% of liver transplants. Right. So that's pretty telling. I think part of it is because, you know, we're more aware that it happens. We're able to, you know, do imaging to assess, you know, fibro scans, ultrasounds, things of that nature, do imaging to assess the amount of liver fat accumulation and liver scarring, which is called fibrosis. And also we just have an appreciation that it very much is like maybe one of the first things that could potentially go wrong. You know, this is why we're seeing younger diagnosis, younger identification, and it's a sign that things are not working well metabolically for you. And if they continue, more bad things can happen. That would probably be, and the thing with the liver that I should add is that it's extremely sensitive, right? It is the site of where a lot of fat and carbohydrate metabolism happens, which is just a fancy way to say it's a lot of decisions in the body that have to do with where's fat going to go, how our blood sugar levels are going to be regulated. A lot of that comes back to the liver, but it's also very sensitive to irregularities in those areas. So it's like a two-way street. And yeah, I mean, there's just something about, you know, there's something about the liver that really people that, you know, whether it's the detoxification aspect of it or, you know, there's something about it that gets people like compelled to act. I think in the same way, like with blood work, I feel like with blood work, you know, high blood sugar compels people to act more than maybe high cholesterol, high blood pressure, you know, and that's just my experience. Like there's certain things that get people going more than others. And I think, you know, fatty liver disease and issues with the liver is definitely one of them.
Yeah, for sure, dude. And I mean, we can talk about all the kind of individual differences that, you know, come with metabolic disease, come with, you know, different diagnoses or different, like, you know, you mentioned like diagnostic criteria, stuff that, you know, doctors, physicians are diagnosing people with and how they use that from like a blood work standpoint and symptoms and all that stuff. But in your experience and what you've seen relating more to the liver, like why are people getting fatty liver? Like how is that happening? And I know we listed, you know, like diagnostic criteria, diagnostic tools, further imaging. Like I do think there is a big asterisk here is like, as we advance and, you know, modern technology, modern healthcare, like our vision towards some of these things have been expanded, and the relationship that all these things have together. So I think there's an element of like, oh yeah, we're more aware of it now. But in addition to diagnostic tools and things that we're using, I say we're like, you and I are in the labs, like doing an ultrasound on somebody, but like, you know, medical providers and people are doing with their patients now. So I get that, you know, with those advancements, we see increased diagnosis, just like all the other stuff that, you know, we could talk about: heart disease, you know, stroke, diabetes, all these things. That's why we've seen these things continue to progress over the years. But what is it about fatty liver? Like, why is that becoming so common these days? Do you think, outside of just better diagnostic tools that we have access to, if you had to say one or two or whatever?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, so it's to your point, it's absolutely, that plays a role for all conditions, for sure. But I think what I would say is that the increase in knowledge and awareness is happening more rapidly than other conditions, okay? Like, so for example, some new research came out that, you know, fatty liver diagnosis under the age of 45 increases the risk of certain types of cancers, like colorectal cancer, which is like already problematic cancer. So I think that's part of it. Now, like, on the whole, like, you know, people end up with fatty liver not for drastically different reasons than they end up with other conditions, like, let's say, a pre or type 2 diabetes. Things haven't been quite right on the food front. They haven't been quite right on the exercise front. But the thing that makes the liver unique is that it is, like I kind of mentioned earlier, it's so intertwined with different systems. So, like, I kind of say there's four pillars for fatty liver disease, right? There's insulin resistance, high triglycerides, inflammation, and microbiome imbalances. Right. And so each of these, for different reasons, is becoming more problematic. Let's put it that way. You know, even thinking about antibiotic use, antibiotic use is a risk factor for otherwise healthy people to get fatty liver. So if let's say they're metabolically healthy, but they have a history of antibiotic use, that is a risk factor for fatty liver. In part, this is an oversimplification, but in part because the gut microbiome and the liver, like I said, the digestive system and the liver are connected. So their fates are kind of intertwined, right? So you could look to all of these different explanations. People try and simplify it, of course. You know, they try and say it's like, you know, they'll say it's fructose, it's this or that. I mean, the reality is the systems at play here are extremely complicated, right? And part of it, again, has to do with the liver being very sensitive. So if one or two or three inputs change, the liver will feel it.
Totally, dude. And honestly, that response is why I have you on the podcast. Like those kind of contextual kind of responses are the things that I want us to think about, the things I want the listener to be thinking about and how it might pertain to them in their lives. And, you know, for me, what I heard from that little monologue there is like, you know, there's a lot of confounding variables that can contribute to good liver health or poor liver health. But, you know, from an oversimplification standpoint, I think a lot of people will initially just say, oh yeah, you know, you're overweight and you have more visceral fat and therefore you have a fatty liver, which, you know, of course there's, you know, some of those variables and those things can play into this, but we're seeing quote unquote, like relatively healthy people, you know, also get liver disease or also have cirrhosis or scarring of the liver, you know, kind of independent of, you know, whether or not they have an ideal, you know, BMI or body fat percentage given their gender or their age or whatever it is. And I think acknowledging all these different variables is important because it gives us a lot of different directions that we could discuss, but also for people to look in their own life, if they do get their blood work done, it's like, oh shit. Yeah. You know, my ALT is elevated or, you know, some of these things are a little out of place. And usually a lot of these things, like if we're being real, like they're all kind of like you mentioned, like they're all connected with one another, man. If someone has a high blood pressure, they also have, you know, high cholesterol or high LDL or ApoB, and, you know, they have insulin resistance. And like, I'll show you somebody that likely has early stages of like fatty liver accumulation as well. Right. So it's not that these things are all happening independent of one another, but when it comes to the liver, it's not as simple as like, oh yeah, you're overweight or you're obese. Like you have fatty liver. It's a little bit more nuanced and complicated than that. And I think that's fun. I think that's a cool thing, but I just want people to realize that there's a lot of variables that can factor into whether or not you're diagnosed with that or have a likelihood of, you know, accumulating some of this over your life span. So
yeah, and I mean, a great example, to be honest, is like there's a lot of evidence that shows that, you know, being more physically active and modifying your diet, it, even without a significant change to body weight, reduces the amount of fat in your liver. Now, the reality, again, just to build on that. So the liver weighs 3 pounds. All you need is for 5% of that or more to be accumulated fat, to be considered to have a fatty liver. So that's like, you know, my mental math's not very good, but that's like what, 0.15 pounds. That's nothing. It's not like a mound of fat on your liver, right? Which is why we can see. So fatty liver is a disease that is something's going wrong with fat metabolism, not necessarily with like, yeah. So it basically means fat is being stored where it shouldn't be. Right. And it's for the various reasons that I mentioned, the four factors that kind of contribute to that. And the other thought I was going to bring, sorry, I lost my thought for a second. One of the factors I think that, whether it's playing a role already or it will play a bigger role in the future, is obviously social media is playing a large role now in dictating or certainly providing information around nutrition. And a lot of foods and types of, I think the types of dialogue that gets amplified are dialogue where it's like, hey, oh, you thought this was good. This is actually crap. You know what I mean? Like, don't, you know, canned beans, canned fish, like if it's canned, it's bad. It's horrible for you. You know, leafy greens have this anti-nutrient, beans have this anti-nutrient, fish has too much mercury. So all these food groups where the cost benefit of whatever, you know, compound they have in them that you may say is not good, you know, the cost benefit goes to benefit. They're good for you. All the human evidence shows, and we can break it down further. But I think people are more scared about certain foods, which make a big difference. Like if you have been led to believe that there are like too many lectins in beans and then they're the worst things for you, then what are you going to do with the information that, you know, even as little as a quarter cup of beans a day or can reduce insulin resistance, or adding a quarter cup of beans to a cup of rice drastically changes how it affects your blood sugar levels and so on and so forth, right? Or the fat, yeah, I mean, the list goes on, or that beans positively influence the gut microbiome, and that many people with a fatty liver have imbalances in their gut bacteria, you know, which then contributes to the fatty liver, right? So there's just, I think a lot of foods that are very, very useful, they get points docked against them by certain people online. And again, it's hard to quantify the effect of that, to be honest. But I feel there's something there.
Yeah, I'm happy you bring that up too, because I have seen personally as well, and we've talked about this a ton on the podcast before, but just like the vilification of a ton of different foods that, man, if we listed out like our one of the more health promoting foods, I mean, you listed a handful of them, but are usually things that people are questioning or scared of, or, you know, maybe have some interest in, but they hear somebody say, oh yeah, there's lectins in these things and they're anti-nutrients and they're stripping nutrients from your body, and therefore you shouldn't be eating these things. When in reality, it's like, no, they're high fiber, the nutrients they have, and then cancel out any of the lectins or anti-nutrients that you might even actually get from that product as well. And not to mention all the micronutrients, all the things that are included in that, you know, plant compound, or if we're talking about different protein sources or whatever, that are going to be health promoting, that can be helpful for your liver, that can be helpful from an appetite suppression standpoint, that can be helpful from, you know, body recomposition or weight loss, or eating in a way that is like, you know, contributing to your calorie needs, but your micronutrient needs at the end of the day. And I don't know about you, man, but the same people that talk about foods in those way, I rarely see talk about the dangers of alcohol. And ironically, the things that I see a lot is them promoting their organic wine clubs that they're in, or they're not acknowledging the fact that alcohol has a role to play. And I know not everybody drinks listening to this podcast, and, you know, this might be a segment where, you know, maybe it doesn't apply to you, but it applies to a fuck ton of people. Like alcohol consumption has been so normalized in our society, and it's something that is part of everybody's like habitual daily routine in certain situations. Or maybe they're, you know, more binge drinking or overindulging, you know, a couple times a week or once a week or a few times a month, like whatever it is. And this is not, you know, a transition to demonize alcohol and to say it never has a place in your life. But it's funny to me that when we look at all the information out there, all the things that, you know, nutrition influencers or accounts or things are talking about, and when they start attacking or start talking about glyphosates and chickpeas, or, you know, the mold in the coffee that might be there, and, you know, all of these kind of things that, you know, you might realize like, what the fuck can I actually eat at the end of the day? You know, the things that aren't acknowledged as much are things like alcohol, which I think can have a huge, you know, just profound impact if we're talking about fatty liver disease, but just your health in general. And I wanted to use this as a transition and just bring up the idea of alcohol consumption and why that can be damaging to your liver. Like why specifically, you know, we have, you know, alcoholic fatty liver disease diagnosis these days, and why that should be a starting point, in my opinion, for a lot of people. You can agree or disagree with that, but like why addressing right. alcohol intake could be the thing that really helps people see improvements and just help build from there. But let's just talk about alcohol related to the liver. Like if we want to talk about the metabolism on a general level, we can do that too. But where is sure. your stance on alcohol, and how would you describe that to somebody sitting here where it's like, hey, I drink quite a bit, but like, why is that bad for my liver? Like, what would you say to somebody?
Yeah, well, So first of all, I would say the following. I mean, in terms of like, you know, liver disease, you're much like statistically speaking, you know, 1 in 3 adults globally have it. You know, most of those adults don't have it primarily from alcohol excess. Like you're talking drinks in the realm of like 15 to 20 drinks a week to peg it to alcohol, right? And obviously the liver plays a role in metabolizing alcohol. How it plays a role in metabolizing fructose. Which is a fancy way to say you drink alcohol, your liver has to go to work, right? The more alcohol, the more work it has to do. And then you can kind of go from there, right? If we want to oversimplify it. Now, people bring up the topic of drinking with me a lot, sometimes purely in the context of caloric value. And then sometimes in the context of like, is this going to be a problem for my liver? I mean, and you know, when every time new evidence comes out, it's kind of always like less alcohol, even less is better, even less, right? The studies I've seen for fatty liver, in terms of like, if someone, let's say you take a person in front of you, right? And they're like, they're going to drink no matter what. They like alcohol. It's part of their life. And they want to know like, what are reputable journals saying about the safe amount for fatty liver? I've seen 3 to 4 drinks a week max. Okay. That's what I've seen in terms of some evidence. What I tell people with as relates to alcohol is less is more, right? If they're receptive to that message, you know, it's up, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a personal decision, of course. And independent of that, just like drinking sugar-sweetened beverages like pop, I mean, where's somebody at? Are they receptive to modifying that behavior, or are they going to think about other behaviors they want to modify instead, and then kind of going from there? I think with any behavior that could be potentially problematic, you are going to get the more, you know, beneficial behaviors you accumulate, you're going to get some protection against those behaviors, right? So it's tough. That's where you get down to the individual. But I would say, yeah, I mean, look, less is more. I'm going to guess you might give a similar message.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Like the more... And again, I'm not somebody here that's saying everybody needs to be sober the rest of their life. Like, quite frankly, I've had this discussion recently with somebody, but this whole idea that like somebody always has to make every single health promoting decision in every single context, I don't know if that's the right answer. Like, I don't want us to be up here and sit here and say that, yeah, you should always. And of course, you should make your best effort a lot of these things, but you know, being in the mindset of like, I can never do anything out of the norm or ever do anything that's going to be quote unquote, you know, maybe not as health promoting as some of these other things. Like I can't sit here and say that's people's best lives. I know it's not mine personally. Mm-hmm. And I giving permission to people to, you know, think similarly where it's like, hey, you know what? Alcohol, I heard Andy and Luke talk about it. It's pretty destructive. It can fuck with my liver. It can mess with my body yep. composition. It can make it hard to sleep. You know, it can fuck with my recovery. It can, you know, inhibit a lot of my inhibitions and make me eat worse foods when I'm drinking alcohol and stay up later. Like there's a lot of indirect, you know, complications of alcohol in addition to things alcohol is directly doing to your body. But at the end of the day, like, I don't want people to sit here and think that they can never drink ever again. I just want people to be more informed, you know, consumers, decision makers, and appreciate the fact that like everything has a fucking trade-off, right? And you drinking 7 times a week or having 7 beers a week, and you're sitting in a position where, hey, you know what? Blood markers aren't where I want them to be. You know, maybe my body composition isn't where I want it to be. I have low energy. Like there are things impacted, but you know, I do have fun when I drink those things. It's like, okay, like, you know, part of your healthiest, your best life might look like you saying no to things more frequently at the same time as well. So people have to sit there and find their own balance of how this pertains to their life. But I think at the end of the day, less, like you said, is more. And if people can get to the point where they're not drinking alcohol at all, or at least experiment for a period of time, I think that could be a really helpful kind of experience for a lot of people. Cause then you can start to appreciate, like, oh yeah, you know what? The environment or the circumstance that I was in was always dictating when I drank or not, right? Like, I just let other people, or I let the situation I was in tell me if I was drinking or not. Where people can actually, if they go sober, if they go a month without drinking, that's why I'm a fan of like something like, Sober January or whatever it's called.
Right.
But like taking a break can teach people how to say no and teach people when they might want to indulge or not want to indulge. And more often than not, when done in a good headspace, like doing something like this with your health and doing things that are more difficult for you, is just going to make it easier for you down the road. And what I want us to help people appreciate is the fact that it's like, it's going to make a big difference on your metabolic health, on your liver health, on your performance, on your body composition, on your ability to do things in the future that are more health promoting. But it comes from a place of curiosity and just being honest with yourself of like, hey, is what I'm doing right now actually helpful for me? And, you know, people can go cold turkey, not drink ever again and live happily ever after. Right. Great. You know, some people might have a little bit more modified approach, but I think just making an effort to change some of these things is what I want people to appreciate and just recalibrate what it is they're actually doing and understand that there's trade-offs to what you're doing. And, you know, more drinking for this person might mean more negative consequences, and it might take you changing those things while we still can, right? Before you get a diagnosis or before some of these bad things can start to happen where you're forced to do that, like start to be more proactive about this shit. And you'll be thanking yourself in the future for sure.
Yeah, you put it really well. It's a tough one. And the only thing I'll say on top of that is like, I encourage my clients to do two things, right? Which is to be like self-reflective and self-observant, like to know themselves, to try their best to know themselves and know what is on the table for them to alter or not. And then also, it's to do the best they can with what they've got, right? Which whatever that, you know, that means different things for different people. And I think if you kind of like embody those two sentiments, you can kind of get a sense of what direction you're going to go with certain behaviors. And obviously, you know, alcohol drinking is one behavior. And then there's like a million other different behaviors around what we put into our bodies. It's a tough one because, you know, for me, it's not a topic of great. I happen to be someone who hasn't, like, I'll drink occasionally, whatever the case may be. It's not a big topic for me, but equally, I know, you know, many individuals for whom like it's a massive part of socializing and so on. And then also many people who have, you know, gone completely abstinent. So it's tough. No, I think you put forward a very, a friendly message on that. So fair enough.
Yeah. I have something that just popped into my mind because I think, you know, when drinking, you know, taken too far, and it's ironic because we talked about like forms of escapism, like to start this podcast, mm-hmm. like let's be real, man. A lot of people turn to alcohol, to vape pens, to, you know, drugs like of all kinds. There's a lot of forms of escapism that people can use that might not be as healthy as going to a Real Madrid game, right? Like there's a sure. spectrum to a lot of these things. And I've unfortunately been on the side where, you know, working in a clinical setting, I know you can share a lot of similar stories, but one thing that I remember very vividly, it was a huge perspective shift, and it was something that kind of fucked me up in the moment, but it's something that we can reflect on and all learn from. But there was a rotation that I had at one of my hospitals when I was a dietetic intern. And I was on this, like, it was like the kidney and like hepatic floor, the liver floor. So there was like kind of a specialized hospital. And this whole wing was dedicated to like liver patients and like dialysis and kidney patients. And I had this client who, or not client, but a patient that I saw who was in there. He had been in there a few times. I met him for the first time, but you see in his chart, oh yeah, frequent hospitalization. He was a tribal, I say kid, because he was like 25 years old at the time, mm-hmm. which is super young. I wouldn't say massively overweight, right? Like definitely was carrying around a little bit of extra weight, but to the naked eye, like a lot of people wouldn't sit here and say, oh yeah, he's morbidly obese, right? Or, you know, you wouldn't look at this guy and think like everything and every organ in his body is fucked up. But this was a guy who was an alcoholic who drank a ton. We live in an area where there's a lot of Indian reservations. So he was belonging to a tribe where that's just part of the culture. It's part of the, you know, the daily lifestyle that a lot of these people partake in. But I remember having some education, and I thought we had a breakthrough, whatever that meant at the time. And later that day, I remember like a code being called. I'm not sure what color code was, that, you know, it's like a rapid response to that room. I didn't know of it at the time, or I didn't think anything, but I looked back when I went the next day and I was going to go check in on with him, because I told him I would come and say hi to him or talk to him before he left that day. And he had died that day that I had talked to him. And I remember just thinking like, man, dude, and quite frankly, yeah, there was other things that contributed to that for sure. But really at the end of the day, it was alcohol. It was somebody who drank, you know, 3, 4, 5 drinks a day, hard alcohol a lot too. And it's one of those things where that's not uncommon for people. Like, that's not something that people are listening here and are shocked that people do that. That's very built into people's lives, and it's an extreme example, but just know that it can happen. And since that day, since, you know, these exposures to all these different types of experiences that I had as a clinical dietitian, it just really helps me have these conversations or to reflect back on things, because I think it helps just paint a picture of how this can play out in people's lives. And unfortunately, if it's not addressed or we don't talk about it enough, like, shit like that could happen to somebody, you know, and that's just the worst thing that could happen to people. And, you know, I'm sure the parents of everyone was devastated, but it was something for me that like devastated me, because I was like, damn, that shit happens quick, bro. And it was just something that played out right before my eyes. So I thought of that as you were talking about kind of the alcohol stuff, because it can happen to anybody at any age, at any kind of quote unquote health status, because you can't always see what's happening on the inside.
Yeah, you know, look, and stories like that and recollections like that are important. It's interesting, because if I think about myself, like, I'm someone who definitely, even with my content, I always look at, okay, the positive, this does this beneficial thing. But for being honest, yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, people do need to hear that, you know, and perhaps more than sometimes, that listen, I mean, there's certain behaviors that could be really detrimental to you. It is so tough, and this is what we have to do. This is what we have to do on a daily basis, is walk that fine line between being objective about the risks of certain behaviors, but also that, you know, there are sometimes more extreme examples that aren't applicable to certain people. And then how do you, you know, not be overly stigmatizing? It's a challenge. It's a line that we have to walk all the time, right? When it comes to like the world of nutrition and health. So but your personal experiences, you go through something like that, it's going to shift your perspective on things, right? And so that makes perfect sense.
Totally. Kind of not a hard pivot, but a soft pivot, as we're talking about kind of like, you know, individual things or nutrients as it pertains to the liver. You mentioned something a little while back. You mentioned a word, fructose, which was something that I had texted you about, and something that I think the general consumer has likely heard about at some point, or heard some, you know, Instagram doctor talk about, or has heard a podcast about how fructose is metabolized in the liver, and that's the reason why people are unhealthy, and that's what's causing insulin resistance, and that's, you know, that's what everybody should be avoiding at all costs. And people going to the extreme of saying like, yeah, you should never eat fruit because fruit predominantly has fructose as its carbohydrate source in there. And that has been something to me, in speaking of just like my experience as a dietitian, like since leaving school and since posting content on online space, like I've never thought I'd have to go to war and defend fucking bananas at the end of the day, right? And to defend eating a, you know, a pack of blueberries each week, and all these things that, you know, these positive things that come from fruit. And we have different camps, different people who, yeah, maybe kind of exist more in the lower carb community. Really popular people who maybe are kind of notorious for like spreading a little bit more misinformation, especially around nutrition. I'm thinking of like Dr. Lustwig, who has been on a ton of different podcasts, but this specific kind of example I'm giving is, I remember this last year, he went on Andrew Huberman's podcast and he was talking about fructose and how that is the thing, independent of everything else, that's leading to liver disease and all this stuff going on. You know, I'm curious, and maybe we take a step back before we keep taking steps forward here, of like, what is fructose? Why does it relate to the liver? And then maybe we'll talk about why that shouldn't be of the most, you know, concerning thing for people when we're talking about liver health. But if you had to take a step back and just say, yeah, you know what, fructose is this, and this is how it's relevant to the conversation, like, what would you say to somebody in that context?
Yeah, no, there's a lot there. So I'm going to give some simple answers, and then we're going to evolve it here. I mean, the thing is this, is that, you know, fructose 50% approximately of fructose intake in the United States is from sugar sweetened beverages, which is just like a fancy neutral term for like soda and flavored coffees and energy drinks, things of this nature, right? So that's 50%. So that's, you know, essentially the majority comes from those foods. Now, the other factor that you have to keep in mind is that fruit and 100% fruit juice also contains fructose. That represents a much smaller portion of fructose intake in the United States, I think closer to 10 to 15%, right? So if you're talking fructose intake, one of the reasons I don't on my page talk about it much is because the advice, and now there's a lot of carryover here, which I'm going to talk about, the advice pretty much boils down to like, don't drink 3 or 4 cans of soda a day, you know? And like, there's only so many times for someone like myself, who's like interested in science, there's only so many times I'm willing to even say that message. Right? Because if someone sat in front of my seat, I almost have a bias that that's a behavior that either they're right now not engaging in, or that they're willing to change as part of a broader thing. And that we almost don't even need to talk about it. It almost goes without saying. And why do I bring up 3 or 4 cans a day? Well, there was a study done in 2014. Okay. And the authors were very reputable scientists. Dr. David Jenkins, who came up with the portfolio diet to lower cholesterol, Thomas Wolliver, who was my professor at the University of Toronto, who's like a pioneer in glycemic index. We're talking like smart people, okay? We're not talking randoms, you know, on TikTok. We're talking like top of their class type of scientists. And what they found in this particular study is that it takes 100 grams or more of fructose a day. And let's say the average American, I believe, consumes 50 to 60 grams. Now, obviously, to make that average, there are some people who are consuming a lot and some people who are consuming a little, right? So it takes 100 plus grams of fructose to increase liver enzyme levels and increase liver fat storage. Now, fructose, and I kind of got ahead of myself there, fructose is a sugar. It's a type of sugar. Like, there's glucose, there's fructose, there's sucrose. But fructose is unique because, unlike glucose, fructose is metabolized in the liver by the liver cells. So that's what sets it apart. And so sometimes people put forward hypothesis, whatever the correct singular there is. I'm usually pretty good with words, but that high fructose intake, and fructose intake has gone up because sugar-sweetened beverages are sweetened with high fructose corn syrup, which has a lot of fructose. As fructose intake goes up, the load on the liver, the demand on the liver is higher, because it has to metabolize the fructose, and it does multiple things. This is the hypothesis. It causes the liver to create more fat, right? And remember, fatty liver disease is a condition of bad fat metabolism, which means fatty acids are kind of being created and stored in a way they shouldn't be. So fructose potentially increases, you know, fat creation in the liver. And then also it may interfere with the gut microbiome. That's another hypothesis. And again, I mentioned a few times today that the microbiome and the liver are connected. But the problem is, of talking about this, is that if 50% of fructose comes from pop and soda, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, this is a relevant topic, but guess what? I mean, don't drink you cannot drink 4 cans of pop a day. Now, the other problem is maybe you can, because if you drink 4 cans of pop, you have 400 calories of soda a day. What if the other 1600 or 2600 calories of what you're eating are impeccable? Are you know, those behaviors don't go together usually. So how do that person, are they going to be okay? I mean, probably they're not going to end up with a fatty liver, right? So it's very interesting. Anyway, so I threw a lot out there. You can, you know, pick away and respond at it, but there's just a few thoughts.
I appreciate that response. And I wanted to interject kind of early on and just validate your thought process, but I kind of waited to the end because I couldn't agree more with just this whole concept of like differentiating where different sources of fructose are coming from. And a lot of people making the argument that fructose is bad, it's leading to insulin resistance, leading to fatty liver, it's leading to, you know, all these health complications. And they're using examples of like Oreos and soda and sugar sweetened beverages, or, you know, drinks, or, you know, coffee, you know, sweeteners or milkshakes, or, you know, even just like juice in general, right? The amount of, you know, sugar, empty calories you might get from juice compared to actually eating some of those fruits. Not to say that juice doesn't have a place, but I just think differentiating like where you get this fructose from really matters, and context matters when we discuss this shit, because no fucking shit, you shouldn't drink five, you know, sodas a day, or full sugar sodas, right? Or a liter of soda every single day, or two energy drinks that have 300 calories a piece that have 50 grams of sugar per serving, right? So I see this all the time with seed oils as well. Like, seed oils get this bad rap and they're pro-inflammatory. And, you know, there's all these, you know, mechanisms that can happen when you eat seed oils. And usually the basis of that conversation or recommendations, like, eating less seed oils means you're eating less fast food or less fried food, right? Less food that has been, you know, stripped of a lot of nutrients. You know, seed oils, you know, commonly are going to be, you know, put in a lot of ultra refined products, hyper palatable products, things that are really easy to overeat, not to mention the amount of calories you get for lack of nutrients that you eat for those things. But man, when we look at the individual, you know, actual substance of what we're talking about, we look at fructose, or if we look at something like seed oils, and we look at the research, and we take into account other things like you mentioned, where it's like, yeah, you know what, this guy has a quote unquote really good day of eating, and, you know, there's two sodas in the day. Like, is he going to be unhealthy? It's like, man, as long as calories are equated, if we're getting a lot of nutrients, or we don't, you know, eat an overconsumption of calories consistently over time, we don't have a ton of extra body weight. Like, there's a lot of confounding variables here that dictate whether or not, you know, you having your 12-ounce glass of apple juice in the morning is going to be quote unquote health, harmful on your health at the end of the day. So I think differentiating between that is important. And you and I are not arguing for people to consume more fructose in the form of refined sugar products, things that are just going to be high calorie, really delicious, really easy to overconsume, because that's going to lead to other, another host of problems. And I think when we make the comparison too, because people will go as far as saying you shouldn't eat fruit because of that as well. But man, when we're comparing the two, like, the amount of
response to that.
Yeah. And the amount of fructose you might find in a cup of berries, you know, who knows, 3 grams, 4 grams, compared to a 12-ounce soda can where you're getting 50 grams of fructose. It's like, it's not even necessarily fructose always. It's a combination of calories and nutrients and everything that goes on with it. So I'll let you kind of give your 2 cents on that, but I couldn't help myself, because those are some thoughts that always come to mind when we're having these kind of conversations about individual ingredients and so forth.
Yeah, no, 100%. And then, yes. And then we evolve the conversation, right? So 100 grams of fruit has 3 days. So most fruits, 100 gram serving is 3 grams of fructose. And then you're right, you're looking at 5 to 10 times that amount, depending on the size of the pop you're having, right? So, like, from the quantity perspective, there's zero comparison. But then you get into the actual, the science and the real stuff, right? Because my nutrition philosophy is pretty much the following. Let's find the foods that have something, that offer something that other foods don't, and that also, that this something we have a really strong reason to believe is going to be beneficial, okay? So we think about fruits, okay? And there's a family of compounds, so I'll bring a little science in here, called flavonoids. Now, berries have one type of flavonoid called anthocyanins. Citrus fruit have something called flavonones. Those are the only two foods that have those compounds. What we see scientifically is that, now, what flavonoids do in the body, they're potently anti-inflammatory. And the liver, as I mentioned earlier today, is very sensitive. It's very sensitive as well to inflammation. Part of the biggest issues with fatty liver disease is, once the fat starts getting stored, it creates an inflammatory response, which then takes you from fatty liver to more severe forms. And cirrhosis is essentially your liver is just so scarred and damaged, doesn't work, right? So that's all down to or largely down and driven by inflammation accumulated over time. Now, flavonoids found only, not all flavonoids, but many flavonoids are found only in fruit. They are amongst the most potently anti-inflammatory compounds that exist, right? And it's funny, because I created a video the other day saying blueberries have sugar, so why do they help reduce insulin resistance? And the big reason is because anthocyanins, like, a food is much more than just vitamins and minerals and macronutrients. There's also these other things, these phytonutrients, these flavonoids, which affect the body. So what anthocyanins do is they actually improve fat metabolism by pushing fat into fat cells, or they lead to the expression of proteins that push fat into fat cells where they're supposed to be, reducing the likelihood they'll get stored where they aren't supposed to be. So there's a lot more. Like, anytime someone tries to oversimplify nutrition, if I can give a general piece of advice, red flag, because nutrition is very, very complicated. And you could have someone on here who's a PhD in anthocyanins will give like a 10 times more elaborate answer to what I just said, right? So oversimplification, you know, is always problematic. And that's a great reason why it's not straightforward at all, just to pin fructose at all, and why someone like myself was written a book on fatty liver, has a course on fatty liver. I don't even talk about fructose. You know, it's not even relevant. If you're thinking about fructose, you're putting your energy in the wrong direction, straight up. Like you're just like, it's, you're wasting your energy, severe diminishing returns. You know, think about, you know, don't worry about fructose, worry about unique compounds, which we have evidence to show that improves liver health and whether or not you're eating them. You know, that's where you should put your energy. So yeah, a little bit of insight there.
Good, dude. Good. And thank you for that recap. Cause I think that this overarching concept of like, you know, there's a lot of distractions out there that can really take you away, or actually, you know, and maybe it was said in good faith by this said person, but it could be taking you further away from things that you could actually be doing that are meaningful to see progressions in your health or your liver health or your metabolic health or your body composition and so forth. So I think one thing I want us and everyone else to remember is that like this stuff is, it's a lot more complicated, but it can be simple at the same time too, right? Like thinking about overarching kind of concepts here, it's like, hey, plant compounds are going to be pretty health promoting, right? Not to mention the nutrients, but the fiber is as well. Like getting lean sources of protein, probably a good thing, right? Like not overeating a bunch of, you know, fried processed foods, a bunch of added sugars, like just a bunch of simple products. Not to say there's no room for that in your diet, but like limiting that, a good idea. Not drinking a ton of alcohol, good idea. Like all these things that everybody knows, but we need to help people appreciate how it applies to their life and why it's important to actually double down on those, because people aren't doing these things, right? Like people aren't eating enough fiber. People are afraid to eat certain, you know, fiber sources or plants or oats at the end of the day. Right. And there's a lot of information online that is just, it's been consuming to the consumer when of course you and I have a little bit more education on a lot of this stuff than the general consumer, but man, a lot of the people listening to this podcast know more than you need to know. Like, you know enough to act on the things that are going to give you a really good return on your investment. And a lot of it looks like eating diversity, you know, plants, eating a lot of colors, eating a lot of different types of foods and fiber sources. All of those things have very unique properties that are going to help things like your liver and your heart and your insulin resistance, but also help you feel good and also give you energy and also help you recover from your workouts and also just, you know, be less hungry throughout the course of the day. So there's so many things that play into each other. So that's why when you hear somebody go on this tangent around like, oh, fructose, it's metabolized in the liver, it's bypassed, it misses glycolysis, and it leads to more fatty accumulation. It's just like, just thinking about that one mechanism and not accounting for the tens of thousands of other things that could be happening at the same time is, again, I just think it could be more destructive than helpful when people are reading these messages or listening to these messages online. And so that's why I think it's important for us to have these conversations. Just be a reminder, just be a little bit more level-headed and neutral around some of your decision-making and not freak the fuck out because you had a banana that was ripe with your blueberries and walnuts in a smoothie for, you know, your breakfast in the morning. Like that could be a great thing if you're doing that, you know, and in addition to a ton of other types of, you know, dietary protocols that people could be doing, but it's refreshing. It's kind of an echo chamber, you and I talking about this stuff, but I just want it to kind of permeate into people's minds a little bit of like, you know, why we think the way we do and why we think that this is a good way for most people to think, the general public to think around their nutrition, because a lot of the other stuff can be more of a distraction and be destructive sometimes at the end of the day.
Yeah. It's tough. And just hearing you say that, I mean, the thing is like, we are, you know, I think we all have like, as dietitians, especially if we're on social media, we're thinking about stuff a lot. We have our own philosophies that we develop. And it is true. There's a lot of different people out there with a lot of different philosophies. And, you know, as I get older, I kind of come to this realization that, you know, I go a certain direction with my content, with my inquiry into science. And for those whom it speaks to, you know, come on in and like, let me, you know, show you like the path that I've chosen to go down in this world and the angles I take and the reasons why I take them. But I become less and less concerned with, you know, trying to convince someone who is like compelled, you know, to do a certain unorthodox approach to eating. Like, I don't get any joy from trying to convince or take someone down or whatever the case may be, right? It's so complicated because different people are different stages as well in terms of how they feel, right? If you're not feeling great, it's going to be, you know, and certain foods, which otherwise you know, you might tolerate well if you're doing great, that you might feel not great after eating them. And then you start to like confound what like the reasons are. So I guess what's the message I'm trying to say? Like, act soon, right? Because the more issues that build up, the more challenging it will be to resolve them, and the more noise there's going to be around the right decisions for you to make. But it's really tough. It's just sitting here like and coming to terms with that. It's really, really tough out there for the average person to make sense of what's going on.
And I agree, it is tough. And I think the silver lining, or the thing I want people to be hopeful, is like, it could actually be pretty simple for the most part too. And it could be something that, you know, you as a listener or somebody listening to this podcast is like, yeah, you know what, there's a lot of kind of things out there, but if I kind of double down and do a lot of the stuff that maybe we're talking about, or, and one of my questions is going to kind of help answer this a little bit as well. But like, if you start focusing your energy on a lot of these things and doing them more consistently, like, you're going to be in a better spot a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, if you build that into your lifestyle, if you prioritize that, if you start to change your priorities around your nutrition and how you approach yourself and your eating and everything going on with your nutrition. And the last question and the follow-up question, I kind of want it to be more of like a rapid fire thing, but we talked about blueberries or fruits and fructose, just because we were talking about, you know, fructose in general, but what other plant compounds, what other types of food groups, what other types of food items, spices even, are things that you would say, hey, these could be good to incorporate if you can, in terms of liver health, but overall health as well, but kind of talking about the liver still, but is there other food groups and things that you would say come to mind first and foremost that you would put tier one for somebody who's like, hey, what can I do to just eat more nutrients that are going to support my liver? What comes to mind?
Yeah. And so this is where the simplified aspect of it will come in, right? So, okay. So I'm going to be rapid fire. I'm just going to reiterate one quick point. So how I look at nutrition is, let's find foods that offer something other foods don't. Most obvious example is fatty fish, salmon, sardines, only source of EPA and DHA, which is a specific type of omega-3, which we know to be quite good for us. So that's the thing. You do not eat those foods, you do not get that compound, right? That's one. Then you can go to, let's say, nuts and avocado, right? And olives, right? These are pretty much the only rich sources of what's called monounsaturated fat, which is also like, you know, quote unquote, healthy fat. Also source of magnesium, an underconsumed nutrient, vitamin E, potentially underconsumed, high in polyphenols, right? So polyphenols are another group of plant-based compounds, which are very good for the liver, very good for the gut microbiome, right? So nuts contain those. And then you look at fruits and vegetables are obvious, but I'll take it one level further. I would say look to high flavonoid fruits and vegetables, just for the sake of classifying them, because flavonoids, again, are anti-inflammatory compounds. And so what are some examples? Berries and citrus are up there. And then for vegetables, we have artichoke, asparagus, broccoli, onion. I mean, these are conventionally available things. They just happen to be high in this compound that scientists think is actually quite good for us, right? Parsley. So speaking of herbs and spices, like multiple studies, you use more herbs and spices, inflammatory markers go down, gut microbiome improves. It's not going to be miraculous by itself, but it does matter, right? So again, you have fruits and vegetables as the only sources of specific flavonoids. You have nuts and avocados, pretty much the only sources of monounsaturated fat. You have fish. Then you have legumes. Now, I'm a big fan of legumes like lentils, chickpeas, kidney beans, black beans. And the joy with these foods is you only need a small amount to make a big difference. So as little as a quarter cup a day, half a cup a day. What makes legumes unique is that they have fiber and protein in the same place. Like a lot of foods have fiber, a lot of foods have protein. Very few foods have them in the same place in meaningful amount. Now, that's what makes you satiated. It's also what leads to blood sugar regulation. And then again, you get into like their very high prebiotic fiber content, which boosts the gut microbiome. And now most people have imbalances in their gut bacteria. Their high magnesium content, which we know is associated with insulin sensitivity. Most people don't eat enough magnesium. So that's a unique food group, right? It's not like what they offer is not replicated somewhere else. And you could eat, like if you take someone, right? Let's just say you take someone who like likes red meat and they want to eat red meat most of the time. And if you just give someone 500 calories to get those foods in, go have the rest of it could be red meat if you really want. You know what I mean? But just get those in, get these compounds that you're not getting anywhere else. Like quite literally, you are not getting exposed to these compounds. We know that people get these more, like ample evidence they live better lives. They live their best life, right? So yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if I articulate as well as I could have, but that would be maybe the not so rapid fire way I would look at some key food groups.
You definitely did, dude. Yeah. And I'm just sitting here thinking, like, if I heard you say that and I wasn't interviewing you and I didn't have kind of some familiarity with everything going on, like, what would be an action step for me personally of like how I can start to implement, how I can start to think in a certain way, how I can start to actually follow through with a lot of these things. And on our last episode, you and I both talked about how like magnesium consumption could be a good proxy for like mm-hmm. how much nutrients you're getting. I think that could be great. For me, I'm a big fan of tracking just total fiber consumption. Of course, we can see sure. some imperfections with that. Like if someone's just getting fucking 45 grams of, modified wheat starch from the carb balanced tortillas, you know, every day, like that's not going to mm-hmm. get you the same benefits of, you know, you having more diversity and so forth. But for most people, like tracking fiber and including this kind of diversity mindset within your eating pattern, to me, I've seen do wonders for people and to help them just kind of conceptualize of like how they can implement that into their daily routine. The mm-hmm. thing that I've personally done too, and I'd love to hear if you have any other tips or takeaways for people to just implement some of the stuff into their life. But for me, I've really found a lot of enjoyment recently, which is kind of funny for me to say, but like finding recipes, finding new foods, creating a shopping list of things that, you know, we look at your habitual week, man, a lot of people are eating the same shit every day for right. months on end, right? Like how can we diversify that? Or how can we create different combinations of what you're already making? How can we add things to your grocery list and incorporate them a little bit differently this week? It does not have to happen at once, but I want people to also appreciate the fact that like a couple small changes, like someone getting asparagus or getting mushrooms or dicing up a yellow and red onion and putting in the soup this time instead of not doing any onions at all with their other veggies. Like there's small things I think people could do that we can just kind of help build patterns, build consistency around doing some of this stuff without making it super overwhelming and feeling like we have to do everything at once. Because I think even when I listen to podcasts, when I listen to things, I hear people talk about stuff and I internalize it as like, I have to make all these changes at once right now. And that's not the message that I hear from you, nor do is it something that I want to, you know, get across, but I want to reiterate that point because this is something that might take 3 to 6 months for you implementing, trying and then experimenting with stuff. And then you have a completely different food rotation, completely different, you know, menu for the week, completely different recipes that you're trying given the season that you're in. And you might find that your food, you know, quality, enjoyment, satisfaction, adherence improves because of it, but it happens because you took the slow road, right? You didn't try and do everything at once. So I'm curious if you have any other ideas or things that you found, you know, be helpful with your clients or stuff you'd recommend, or if that's something that kind of summarizes, you know, some main points we could get across here.
Yeah, no, perfect. So I'm gonna give a two-part answer. The first part is something you can do right now. And the second part is like kind of like how I look at someone, like some tricks I might give someone to make sure they're running a high-level day in terms of how I view it with like my science, my philosophy. So I think the two most, like, it's my belief, but my belief stems from also looking at data. So I've seen a lot of modeling data that basically shows the following, is that the two food groups that are most underconsumed relative to their influence on health in terms of like longevity are nuts and legumes. Okay. I gave a taste of some of the reasons why. I mean, I could also mention that legumes lower blood sugar and cholesterol, right? So that's something else. But so what can you do about that? That's easy. Well, you could, you know, let's say you can get canned lentils, you could pan fry them, mix them with your rice, get canned chickpeas, pan fry them. You can buy roasted lentils, chickpeas, roasted edamame online as a snack, have it every afternoon, ultra satiating, high fiber, high protein, low glycemic index. Buy a big bag of nuts, any nuts will do, throw them in somewhere at breakfast, throw them into your yogurt, oatmeal, cereal, whatever capacity you have them. Eating, like looking, like going from looking at nuts and legumes as foods like have now and then, as food, as compared to foods to pursue like assertively, I believe that would change a lot of people's lives personally. So that's number one. Number two is I tell my clients, like I teach them my philosophy and I say, listen, if I'm going to look at your day of eating, of course, yes, we can look at macros, protein, and obviously like that's important and the importance of that scales from person to person. But for me, what does not change from person to person, assuming no dietary restrictions, okay, obviously that changes it, right? For me, what does not change from person to person is we have fatty fish, right? Which, look, people don't like fish, they can supplement, fair enough. We have fatty fish, we have legumes, we have nuts or associated foods like avocado and olives, we have fruit, then we have vegetables. you get a serving of a food, you get a serving of that food in a day, you get a point for that group. Can you get five? Can you average four or four and a half out of five over a 7 day period? If yes, my confidence that your diet quality is high goes up. So that would be like how I put it simply. And this is actually something, I don't think, I know if I've ever verbalized it before, but this is something I do with all my clients. This is a big part of my philosophy. And obviously there's more levels to it than that, depending on the person. But at baseline, I believe in that very strongly.
I love that point system, dude. And that might be something I adopt a little bit as well. And I think it just outlines the importance that there's multiple ways to do this. You know, for some people, it might be tracking food for a period of time and actually looking at some of the data or objectively looking at what their numbers were at the end of the day or what kind of their logs look like for the week and reviewing that with their dietitian. For some people, it might be just like a point system or a mental check where it's like, hey, when I sit down at my plate and I'm looking at my plate, it's like, do I have a point here? Do I have a fiber source or do I have a protein or whatever else it is that you might be looking for? It doesn't have to be related to liver health or anything necessarily right now, but come up with a point system in your brain. And that might be something that you think about for a period of time that helps you build a little bit more muscle memory and consistency with that. And, you know, you don't have to think about this when you're 80 years old and you're like, oh shit, do I have my lentils here today? Or would I eat anything this week? It's like, right. Ideally, it's going to be built into your life a little bit more and you'll find some more consistently in a way that you can adhere to over the long term. And again, it'll ebb and flow, but I think I just want people to remember that there's not one way to do this and there's not one perfect strategy that's going to work for everybody. So it might take a little trial and error with a handful of things. It might take working with someone like Andy or myself. It might take, you know, actually tracking your food for a period of time, but just be open-minded and be open to the fact that some of these things that are going to get you to do these behaviors aren't going to be a permanent type of intervention, because ideally you're gonna have to learn how to live without them and use, you know, the knowledge and the skill set that you learned using some of those strategies and tools to just build that into your normal life and not think about it as much going forward. So I want people to think about that, because I think the thing that keeps people from doing that in the first place is the fear of like, I have to track my food for the rest of my life, so therefore I'm not going to track in the first place, so I don't have to handcuff myself to something like that. Where it all depends what intent and, you know, what mindset we have around doing some of these things. And I'm a psychopath, but I think this stuff is fun. You know, I think this is stuff that can really be impactful in people's lives. This is stuff that I've done for myself, food tracking and everything else going along with it. But I feel like I'm in a good place because of it. And I want to like lower the barriers to some of this stuff, because it can be very frightening and scary for a lot of people when, you know, you have all these things happening at once and you have to confront the idea that you have to change a lot of shit. That usually can leave people paralyzed before they actually start acting on anything too. So just my other two cents on that. Yeah.
Everyone's path is different. You know, everyone's path is different. Like I can say for myself personally, I'm not sure I've ever tracked a full day of my eating, but if I have a client who I think it's in their best interest, like my personal path does not influence what I think is best for someone else. You know, and so everyone is very different. And even it's not to say like that I dismiss hitting a protein target, you know, for the right person, being concerned with caloric intake. Obviously, like I take those in mind. So the scoring system has strengths and limitations. It's just simple. That's the thing. It's simple. And more broadly, it's effective for the purpose. And the only thing I'll say is like, I believe a lot in legumes. And again, as little as a quarter cup, half a cup a day. And for anyone out there who's heard something contrary to them, like what I would say is that, you know, if you've heard the blue zone concept before, and I know you have, I mean, maybe for the listener, like the blue zones are areas in the world where people live above average, like length of lives. And they're in all different parts of the world, but the one food group, and they all have different cuisines, the one food group, albeit different members of that family that's in all the blue zones are legumes, right? So that doesn't prove anything, but certainly it's interesting. And they might not tell you that when they're telling you, you know, other things about them or whatever the case may be. So something definitely to keep in mind. And yeah, look, half a cup of lentils, 100 calories. I mean, you got, you know, that's probably the most impactful 100 calories you'll eat in your life, in my opinion. That's it.
Never seen somebody get so passionate, myself included, about talking about legumes, dude, and just some of these other fiber foods. But I think that's the thing that kind of pisses me off sometimes when people are like, fiber isn't essential. And again, this is maybe just more of the carnivore movement and people just dismissing that plants, fiber, you know, a lot of these other nutrients that you find in foods outside of beef liver, you know, like are actually impactful. So it's just the people dismissing that, and, you know, whether it's ill-intended or not, I think most people just are just following and regurgitating what they heard from other people and doing things that, you know, anecdotally that might work for them. And they're documenting that and like trying to convince other people to do that, which again is not their place, and they're not medical professionals, nor should they be advising people in nutrition, but we just kind of see that cycle repeating itself. But with this whole carnivore movement, that's the thing that's like low key pissed me off the most, where it's like, people are talking about fiber. People talk about, you know, nuts, beans, all these things. And they're like, they're non-essential. They, you know, sure, they have nutrients, but so does, you know, a ribeye steak, you know, and the amount of iron you get in a filet is way different than what you'd get in broccoli or whatever. And it's just like, yeah, no shit. But I love your philosophy where it's like, what do other foods bring to the table that the other foods might not, you know? And I think when you kind of like conceptualize that and apply that to your life, you can start to actually implement and create a really diverse diet that's really health promoting, that you might enjoy a ton, that is going to just keep you in the game for longer and keep you as healthy as possible as we get older. Cause that's really the goal here, is to be disease free, to be able to be independent. You know, we're not going to be living in the blue zones, and there's a lot of confounding variables that go into, you know, lifespan, of course, but like, man, doing some of these things that are really health promoting and, you know, emulating success that other populations have. Like, I think there's a lot that we can learn and implement in our own lives. So really well said.
Yeah. I'm just going to say one thing with the carnivore diets we talked about. Like, and for me, like red meat unless someone's a vegan, right? Like, obviously red meat is delicious. It has a lot of unique strength. So I'm not really, you're not going to see me saying, telling people not to eat red meat. But the thing is, red meat statistically is already, it's quite heavily consumed, right? So it's not like, it doesn't fill the category of something with a unique benefit that you're not getting. Like, people are getting it. They're eating red meat already. And as far as the carnivore diet, I mean, how I view the carnivore diet is like, I have a saying, and I said this on a podcast years ago. I said, like, nobody went from eating sweet potato and lentils to keto or carnivore, like they changed their life, right? How I look at the carnivore diet is, unfortunately, what happens is, you know, it's not easy to find a place of peace and tranquility around food. Now, in my life, I'm fortunate. I've gone through ups, like hard times, but I've got to that place. It's very hard to get there. And unfortunately, my belief is that the majority of people who go all the way in on the carnivore diet, who have seen it, they're unfortunately just deferring that process of coming to terms with the fact a lot of different foods exist. They're probably gonna have to find some level of tranquility and peace around that to live their best life. And they're just deferring that process, perhaps not for the first time. And eventually they're going to have to return to the start, and they're going to have to face that reality. And let's just exclude whatever 5-10% of people who do it, who stay with it for an extended period of time. You can even see the cracks on TikTok of big TikTok influencers. You know, they downplay it, but, oh, hey, there's fruit and avocado now. Like, oh, okay. Like, let's not talk about, you know, it's like the proof is in the pudding, but it's just hard for people to see it. Right. So anyway,
Just douse honey on everything and you'll be good to go, man. Yeah. It's funny. It's like camps like that, you know, and you see it with all different type of diet camps out there. Like it's very tribalistic, right? It could be very political, honestly, if we're being real. And of course, what happens is they start moving the goalpost. And, you know, a lot of these diets and these things, you know, when you compare them to other styles of eating, you know, that's where these nuanced conversations come around, where it's like, yeah, you know what? I don't doubt you feel better going, you know, carnivore or plant-based, you know, from day one after, you know, eating more of a traditional like Western diet that a lot of people might be eating. Like, chances are anything you did might feel better and might get you to a better place. But we talk about longevity, if we talk about, you know, what are things that we could do over our lifespan that are going to be a really good return on our investment? Like, a lot of these diet camps might, and not to say it can't be done, but they just miss an opportunity to really create a good relationship with food, with people, and to help people eat a diverse amount of nutrients coming from so many different sources, instead of just the long or the short list of foods that are, you know, accepted or not accepted with whatever dietary protocol that people might be following. So yeah, we've talked about the carnivore diet. I think maybe on our last episode, I had Alan Aragon on the show and we talked about it a little bit too, along with seed oils, but people know my stance. They know your stance, but it's always fun to just talk about it and other things as, you know, we see it play out in our practices and everything. But dude, this was a lot of fun. We didn't get through everything on my list. So maybe we'll do a part three within the next 3 months or 6 months or so. And we'll get you back on, talk about, you know, living without a gallbladder, some other complications related to the liver. I think, you know, when I think of liver stuff, like, you're my guy. And I've loved these last two conversations that we had. And I think a part three could just round out some of the other stuff that might be a little bit more, you know, specialized to small subsets of the population, but are still relevant and still fun and mentally stimulating to talk about. So I've taken up too much of your time already.
Great chat, man. Appreciate it.
Please tell everyone where they can find you. Tell everyone about your course, you know, everything you've got going on. Yeah. I'll plug everything in the show notes as well, but tell people how they can get a hold of you.
Yeah. You can find me. I'm Andy the RD on Instagram, Andy the RD on TikTok, andytherd.com. You'll be able to find all the stuff you need to know about me there. If you're, you know, if you're living with a fatty liver and you want to, you know, use science to reverse it, which is doable, then I'm the guy to help. And the reason why I like liver health so much, and hopefully it came out today, is that it just focuses it, you know. So I'm gonna say one thing, because, you know, you mentioned how I said magnesium is a proxy, right? Well, I actually, liver health is a proxy for my broader nutrition philosophy, because the liver is so sensitive to different issues, and each different issue that's sensitive to requires a slightly different but overlapping nutrition solution. So for me, you know me, I'm like a nerd. I like exploring all these random areas. So focusing on the liver is a way for me to use all that science in one place with a captive audience, right? It's not that I care necessarily about the liver per se, obviously I do, but it's more so that I can bring all the science together and like help someone like literally live their best life, and in doing so, reverse a common condition. So a little tidbit at the end. It's a great chat though, man. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course, bro. Till next time, man. We'll see you soon. Thank you again for listening to this episode. If you found value and enjoyed it, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media. If you do, make sure you tag me so I can say thanks. Or if you're on iTunes, scrolling down and leaving a 5-star review would be much appreciated. And if you ever want to get in touch with me, you can always find me on Instagram at LukeSmithRD. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your day. I'll see you on the next episode.